From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We hear a lot about immigration reform these days, and no wonder. With 11 million undocumented immigrants living in America, there are a lot of lives and futures at stake. We're going to talk about immigration in this hour. So let's begin by remembering that behind every case of an undocumented worker is a person with a story.
I landed a profile of Mark Zuckerberg for The New Yorker. I took him out for a walk. It was like an hour-long walk from Facebook to his house, the house that he found on Craigslist, of all places. Zuckerberg is a really interesting guy. So we're out for a walk, and at one point, Mark turned to me and goes, "So where are you from, Jose?" And I couldn't answer. I stopped. I literally stopped walking, and I just, like, glared at him. You know, it's one of those things that how can you not answer a very simple question? I should just say, as an undocumented person who's been living in this country since I was 12, I live in all – it's all gray area. And I was like, this is so surreal. And at that point, I was about to turn 30. This driver's license that I got fraudulently is about to expire. And the driver's license was my only form of ID. If I lose that, then what do I do, you know?
Jose Antonio Vargas was born in the Philippines. He came to America when he was 12. He's been here ever since, just not legally. He became a journalist, worked his way to the top of his profession, and then, he tells Steve Paulson, in 2011 decided he was tired of lying.
So you did the thing that would be the last thing in the world anyone would suggest. You wrote a huge story for the New York Times Magazine coming out saying you are undocumented. You're not legally here.
You know, for me, it was like, how do I do this in such a big way that I couldn't just be speaking for me, that I could be speaking for other people who are experiencing the exact same thing? Undocumented people are completely integrated in American life. We're visibly invisible.
But on the other hand, I mean, you had to be thinking, as soon as you made this public, and so everyone could see this, that you were going to get booted out of the country.
Well, I mean, look, I'm a journalist, right? I'm trained to think about various scenarios. So I prepared myself for all the scenarios, including deportation. Like, what do I do? Do I, like, pack all my stuff and just in case I did get deported? Like, I have a lot of stuff here. Like, what do I do, you know? What I wasn't prepared for, frankly, was, like, nothing happened. I was expecting to hear from the Department of Homeland Security. Nothing. And that's why, you know, a few months into this, I contacted the editor of Time Magazine, Rick Stengel, and I said, I want to write a story about why I haven't gotten deported.
Well, you really were pushing it.
Well, I don't mean to laugh about this, but, like, I'm trying as hard as I can to underscore just the almost absurd reality that people like me have to go through.
And we should point out, I mean, this is still very real. I mean, you could get deported.
Somebody could go to the studio right now and decide to deport me and arrest me, you know? Like, they can do that. And I got to tell you, when I was younger, Martin Luther King's book, Letter from Birmingham Jail, provided an enormous amount of peace to me. Because, you know, like, we live in a country of laws. And for Martin Luther King to quote St. Augustine and say, an unjust law is no law at all, that was in my head, you know, the 5 years that I was a reporter for the Washington Post, living and walking around Washington, D.C. and going to the White House and going to press conferences, Capitol Hill. And, like, you know, I was like a walking time bomb. I was just sure that I was going to explode. I mean, I remember the morning after the Christmas during the Iowa caucuses in 2007, and the Washington Post sent me to Iowa to cover the caucuses. And there I am walking around with Mike Huckabee going pheasant hunting. And Huckabee starts talking about these illegal alien people. And I wanted to raise my hand and say, Governor, I'm one of these illegal aliens you're talking about, and I'm not from Mars. And I felt so cowardly never doing it.
So even though you have been living here since what? Since you were 12 years old. I mean, living in the United States, you basically have no way to become a legal citizen?
So there's a couple of ways. One way is for me to just leave. Go to the Philippines, where I haven't been since I was 12, and accept the 10-year bar before I could apply to get back. The other way is to marry a man I'm gay, so I can't pretend to be too late now. I could do that. I could marry a guy. I live in New York, and New York State recognizes same-sex marriage. But unfortunately, the federal government, because of the Defense of Marriage Act, does not. So I'm still stuck in the same limbo. One lawyer suggested, why don't you get married in New York, find somebody to marry, then sue the federal government.
It's a little more than you want to take on.
Or actually, one of my friends said, why don't you get together with a transgender person and really shake this up? You know, and I'm like, oh, no. Like, I think I'm like a walking, uncomfortable conversation as it is. Like, I don't think I can handle, you know.
But yeah. I mean, that's partly what you're saying is that this is a conversation no one wants to have. And I guess that's what's prevented you from getting deported. I mean, no one wants to take this on because the issues are not only so difficult to talk about, but there's absurdity here.
It's absurdity, but also I think it's a complicated conversation because we live in a country that doesn't honor our own history. Like, I feel like I'm literally just like, okay, remember that time between 1892 and 1956 when 12 million undocumented white people from Europe crossed the border known as the Atlantic Ocean and then landed on Ellis Island with no papers? They just showed up. They were welcomed. And 1 out of 3 Americans can trace their ancestors to Ellis Island. And here we are nearly 60 years later dealing with 11 million people. So what's the difference? And people are saying, oh, it's overpopulation or, you know, lazy brown people who would tax our resources. I should just say, as an undocumented person who's been living in this country since I was 12, I've been paying taxes since I was 18 years old, since I started working. I have paid so much state and federal taxes, I might as well be a Republican. Because guess what? The IRS doesn't care whether or not I have papers. All they care about is that they get their money every year. Why don't we ever bring that up? And again, how much is the media accountable for that? And I'm saying this as somebody who's also accountable for that. I was in the, you know, I was a reporter for 12 years. I did not want to touch immigration. I was the only Jose reporter anywhere that did not want to touch immigration.
The one subject
I wanted as far away from it as possible. I was like, I want out of that. I'm Filipino, yo. Like, I don't care. You know, like I didn't want any part of it because I was so afraid, you know. And
Well, we should talk a bit about your personal story. I mean, how you originally came here, because you were brought over by your grandparents who were legal immigrants, correct?
Yeah. So I'm like, what, 17 million other households in America. I'm in a mixed status family. My mother decided to give me a better life, and so she sent me to live with my grandparents who had legally immigrated to the United States in the mid-80s. And, you know, I was 12, so I didn't really know about any of this stuff. All I knew was I was in America. 4 years later, when I applied for my driver's license, a driver's permit when I was 16, I didn't tell my grandparents I was going to go to the DMV. I just went by myself. And when I showed the woman at the booth my green card as a proof of identification, she kind of flipped it around twice and looked at me and she said, this is fake. Don't come back here again.
Wow.
That's how I found out.
You didn't know that you were not a legal resident.
It was kind of not talked about. It was just – I was just here. And so after the woman at the DMV told me that, I, you know, rode my bike back home and my grandfather was there. I confronted him and he said, what are you doing showing that to people, the green card that is, and you're not supposed to be here.
So, I mean, your story raises all kinds of questions. I mean, how do you do things like get a driver's license or go to college? I mean, how did you get into college? How do you apply for jobs if you don't have any legal status?
So that's the thing. I mean, I wanted to have a job. And my first job was Subway sandwiches. My grandfather bought me a fake passport and a fake Social Security number. But in the Social Security number and in the card itself, it says not eligible for work. So we went – he drove me to the Kinko's, not too far from where we live. And he basically cut up a small piece of white tape and put it over the line that says not eligible for work. And then we made 25 copies of it. I was 17, I think, at the time. That was what I had to show Subway, was just a photocopied version. And to my surprise, that was fine. Now, that's the same photocopied Social Security that I showed the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, the New Yorker, the Huffington Post.
But what about getting into college?
Getting into college. So this was pre-DREAM Act. So I found that I was undocumented when I was a freshman in high school. So after that, I was like, what's the point, right? I mean, why even go to college? So I never took the SATs. I just wasn't – college wasn't really an option for me. That was my thinking. And then when I was a senior, the principal, who I got to know pretty well, Pat Hyland, was wondering why I wasn't applying to colleges. And mind you, at that point, I was already out as gay. I came out when I was a junior. So I was known – I was the only openly gay kid in school. So I was known as the gay kid in school. So after that, I told the principal that there was this other thing. And Pat Hyland told the high school superintendent, Rich Fisher. And at that point, they were like, do we adopt you? Like, what do we do? And they talked to lawyers, and the lawyers said there's nothing you can do. And so they found this venture capitalist who started a scholarship fund. And that's how I got to college.
Well, and partly what you're saying is it's not just farm workers or nannies who were working under the table. I mean, you're talking, you know, not only journalists, probably doctors, lawyers, teachers.
Yeah. To be an undocumented person in America, this is not a black or white issue. It's all gray area. My grandfather lied for me, but I was an adult and his lies became my lies. And I had to justify being at the Washington Post for 5 years, right? I remember when I got the internship offer from the Washington Post, my first phone call was for my principal, who's become like a mother figure in my life. I called her up and I said, Pat, am I taking somebody else's job? The first thing she said was she laughed. And the second thing is she goes, don't think that way. You know, like you earned this. You earned this. Don't think that way.
So you're saying there's this whole – it's not just about –
underground.
It's not just about whether you're going to get deported or not. It's about, you know, whether you belong here.
Whether you belong and how I justified it to myself morally. The justification was I'm contributing. I'm paying taxes. I'm writing stories that no one else is writing. I'm going to be as good as I possibly can be. I'm going to justify my taking space. That's how I could live with myself.
What does it mean for you to be an American? What does it mean to be an American?
To me, to be an American is to feel free. I think there is the possibility of America, the fact that our history is always unfolding before us, the fact that we're always evolving, the fact that we are always trying to perfect the union. The fact that we promise people, right, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, I love this country. This is my home. I'm an American. I'm just waiting for you to recognize that and give me the papers to show for it. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story.
No, thank you for having me. I'm just glad they haven't deported me yet. You know?
José Antonio Vargas is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He wrote about being an undocumented immigrant in the New York Times and in a cover story for Time magazine. And he told his story to a congressional hearing earlier this year. He's the founder of the nonprofit group Define American. Steve Paulson talked with him. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Why is it that when we talk about immigration, we use cooking metaphors, you know, as in melting pot? Maybe because food is such a powerful expression of cultural identity.
My name is Eddie Wong. The name of my restaurant is Bauhaus, and we serve like Taiwanese-style street food. Bao just means like bun or bread in Chinese. It's portable. It's like the Asian answer to a taco. You know, the original is named after Chairman Mao because Mao's from Hunan, and my technique for the red cooked pork belly is from Hunan, the province. That's where my family's from.
Eddie Wong is New York's latest bad boy chef. His restaurant Bauhaus is a popular East Village late-night spot. He also hosts a kind of underground food show for Vice TV. It's called Fresh Off the Boat. That's also the title of his new memoir. Anne Strangechamps reached him at Argo Studios in New York.
Eddie, you are a chef, a restaurant owner, you've been a lawyer, a stand-up comic, you're kind of an online celebrity, and now you're a writer. But the common theme kind of running through everything you do is what it means to be an American immigrant. So tell me about your family. They came from Taiwan, and you were the first in your family born here in America?
Yeah, I mean, I love the cover of the book because the grandparents are from China, the parents are from Taiwan, and then the children were born in America. And my mom came here when she was 17, and 3 years later, she had me. So even though I'm technically second generation, I many times feel like I'm first generation because we experienced America together.
Was your family very traditional?
Oh, very. Our home was very traditional. We spoke Chinese at home. We ate Chinese food. There's a room in our house where it's just photos of our ancestors and writing on the scrolls. Every once in a while, one of us will always just walk by and koto and pay our respects.
Didn't you write that one of your grandmas actually had bound feet?
Yes. My grandmother on my mom's side had bound feet. That was a very different experience for me to see that. They looked like potatoes, you know, they were mangled. And I felt bad for her, but she was still so strong. But I was very defensive about people saying, oh, you guys are animals. Look what you did to your grandmother's feet. You know, I was like, look, you know, you can't write us off as a culture and as a civilization because of that single act.
A lot of kids growing up in traditional families rebel. You know, they're like, no, I don't want to bow in front of the ancestors. I want to go out and play basketball and eat Kentucky Fried Chicken. What were you like?
Yeah, no, that's totally true there. I remember always kids bringing like Filet-O-Fish to Chinese school and stuff. And no, I definitely rebelled. I just wanted to experience freedom as I saw it in movies and read about it in books and heard about it in songs in America. And for about 18 years of my life, I felt lied to, you know?
What do you mean lied to? How?
For instance, you may have the freedom of free speech, but in class, if you have an opinion that isn't going along with what the teacher says and they think that the other students in high school shouldn't be exposed to it, they'll silence you. And I went to 7 schools in 5 years because I would always ask the difficult questions in class.
Like what? What kind of question would you ask?
For instance, you know, the first time was in kindergarten, I saw photos of Adam and Eve and they were both white. And I said to the teacher, you know, how is it that Adam and Eve are both white, but I look the way I do? And she's like, oh, well, we'll get to the Tower of Babel and you'll understand it then. And I was like, well, it still doesn't really make sense. I really need you to explain this to me. And they wouldn't. And they just made me eat soap.
You know, so what happened when you must have gone home and told your parents that? What did your parents say?
Yeah, you know, my parents were really cool and they would switch me from schools. They knew that they didn't speak the best English at that time. And that a lot of times when we went in, we were just looked at like aliens. So they would just switch me from schools. Especially in third grade, I was pushed down on in the lunch line and somebody called me a chink. And that's when I jumped up and I fought for myself and they locked me in a closet and I peed my pants. And my mom came to school and found me. And she was like, you know what? We will never come back to this school again.
Now, food was always a big part of your family's life. Your parents owned a restaurant, right? But not a Chinese restaurant.
Yeah. My father really tried. He never thought that Americans would pay full price for the Chinese food or Taiwanese food that we ate at home. And he didn't want to open like a Chinese food fast food place. He didn't want to climb up that hill. So he opened American restaurants and he became a millionaire. And I'm really proud of my dad. He really believed in America. He really loved it. And when I grew up, I saw like all the opportunity here. But I also saw, you know, Dad, you didn't get to grow up here. You didn't get to go to school here with these kids. You don't get to see and go into their homes and see like how misunderstood we are and our culture is. And as a second generation, I wanted to say, you know what? This is who we are. So the trademark of these soup dumplings is every single soup dumpling here has 18 folds. You can like see every single distinguished fold. Super hard to do. How is it?
This is awesome. This is awesome. Great idea.
So were you always bringing kids home to your house feeding them dinner?
Yeah, I mean, a ton of kids came over. You know, like my friend Warren across the street, his family's from New Orleans. He'd always come over and lift up the covers on the pots and be like, whoa, wait, why does this chicken have a head and neck and legs? The feet would stick out of the pot. And then, you know, we ate the pig's nose. We would eat the pig's ears. And it was delicious to us. It never seemed weird. So I think a lot of kids definitely got a taste of our culture just coming to my house and looking under the pots.
So you, when you first started working in restaurants, you were, must have been working in your family's restaurant, right?
Yeah, I worked in my family's restaurant, but my dad fired me once, and I ended up working at Boston Market cleaning chicken butts. Yeah, but, so I used to go after school with my friends and just wash the chicken butts.
It's amazing you stayed in the business.
Yeah.
Ça passe, Fobs. We out here in Little Haiti, about to see the world-famous Chef Creole. We're going to tailgate with him and his friends.
Good job, Chef. That's delicious, man.
Then we're going to hit the water, get on a boat. Palm trees are sexy, dude. Palm trees are very sexy. And see how Haitians do in Miami. Peace, peace, y'all.
So what a lot of people, you know, fast forward to you becoming a chef, and there's a section in the book when you're kind of riffing on how much it bugs you when people take a vacation to Burma or something, and then they come home and they say, yeah, I'm going to start cooking Burmese food, and you call that imperialism in a saute pan.
What you're asking me about here now is power, right? Because what you're asking about is kind of the Marco Polo syndrome, where people from a dominant culture will go to a place like Burma, which is a developing country, take the techniques, take the flavors from Burma, come back here and repackage it for a West Village audience, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's kind of I don't like that, because Burmese food, really, I don't want to eat Burmese food on a square plate with drizzle, you know? Like, I don't want to eat Burmese food in a new American setting.
So does it bother you that Rick Bayless has become a superstar chef cooking Mexican food?
If I want to eat Mexican food, I'll go to L.A. and eat it in East L.A., you know? If I want to eat Mexican food, I'll go to Queens or Red Hook Ball Fields. And I think that Rick Bayless really isn't the issue. The issue is dominant culture's power to take things and co-opt and appropriate them. You know, and that is the trick. You want to offer your goods. You want to offer your culture. You want to sell soft power. But if you don't protect it and you don't do it the right way, it's very easy for your culture to be hijacked.
There's a section in the book when you headed off to college and you wound up being pretty critical of other Asian students. What was it that was bothering you?
Well, the thing is that there are lots of Asian people that in America I feel don't really plant their flag here. There's always the model minority myth, and there's always that kind of Confucian thinking where, you know, like, just work hard, respect your parents, you know, show good face for the family, and you'll be fine. Don't start a ruckus. Don't make noise. When I went to college, I visited Asian clubs, and I'd go to a couple meetings. I didn't really join. But I saw that a lot of the cultural programming, it was almost like they were parodying their own culture, you know? When we did, you know, Chinese New Year events, it was like, let's do a lion dance and then we'll do a potluck. Ha, ha, ha. You know, that's what our parents would do. And like, that's cool. You know, lion dance is great. Potluck is great. But like, let's talk about what it's like to preserve Chinese New Year in America. Let's talk about the struggle. Let's talk about the issues that we face. Like, you know, as Asian Americans, like, let's build community. What are the shared issues and problems that we have amongst each other? And that wasn't really the conversation that was happening.
How did your parents respond when you came home from college and talked about some of this stuff?
Huh. My dad was really funny. He was like, man, you think you like the Chinese Martin Luther King or something? And I remember telling him, I was like, no, I'm the Chinese Malcolm X.
Would this conversation be different if I wasn't white?
Well, I didn't know you were not white or white.
Yeah. I'm just curious because there was a blog post you did recently where you said you love white guilt because it's impossible to talk with white people without white guilt. What did you mean?
What I mean is that white people need to know that they are part of dominant culture and that the power that they hold and that they're in the catbird seat. That's all I'm saying. I think you have to understand your role. When I go to the hood, I know my role. You know, like I know what's in my knapsack. Now, I would venture, and I'm not trying to say it in a negative way, white people probably have a little more in their knapsack than a lot of other people do at this time in history and in this country. I just think that wherever you're from, whoever you are, I think you need to recognize the privileges and disadvantages and that you have. When you enter conversations, I think you should be aware of it.
It's your boy, Eddie Wong. We out.
I'm getting mine. Eddie Wong is the owner of the East Village restaurant Bauhaus. He hosts a food show for Vice TV and has just written a memoir. They're both called Fresh Off the Boat. Speaking of the struggle to hold on to your native culture, well, that's an issue with a long and painful history in this country. Ron Korn Jr. is a member of the Menominee tribe. European immigration wiped out much of his ancestors' native culture, including their language. Ron is one of fewer than 20 people who speak the Menominee language fluently. He recently quit his full-time teaching job in order to raise his youngest daughter with the language through immersion. He hopes she'll be the first child in over a generation whose first language is Menominee, not English.
What I'm doing is ensuring that the language goes a generation beyond myself. And I'm going to do that through my kids, you know. I think it's hard for her to want to speak because nobody else does, you know. There's probably about 8 people that speak. We'll call it 10, you know. So that's a reality check. The language, it could die, but the idea that we're trying to preserve is a living language. Pamatishimekot, it lives. So there's words readily available for everything in nature. The word for falling snow is petnon. The word for snow on the ground is cone. Crusted snow, wanai, you know, we say wanai. And the word snowflake is even different yet than both of them. We say peewitsit. The beautiful thing is it's not much easier in the woods, you know, because our language is really based on what's going on out there. But how do we make that transition into today's life too, you know, because we're not always sugaring, we're not always ricing. We spend a lot of days at home, in the office, on the road, and we got to learn to express those things too, you know. The language has to make that transition if it's going to be relevant and if it's going to survive, you know. When I was young, my first main teacher, Watsachiwan, she was starting to get sick and forgetful, you know. One day we were just sitting at her house talking, and she tells me, now I can die, she told me. For 25 years, she said, try to teach someone this language. Now today I've done that. Then she continued on in Menominee, you know. She said, Kanapuch kitchen and you and Sawi and she said, Poninita, she said, Kitapanan, she told me. She says, you know, maybe you're going to be an old man, she says, when you hear these kids talking our language. She said, I love you. Don't give up.
Ron Korn Jr. is a member of the Menominee tribe. His story was produced by Finn Ryan for The Ways, a production of Wisconsin Media Lab. You can see Finn's short film about Ron and his daughter on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, the cross-cultural fermentation that produced the Arabian Nights. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. So if you had to choose the most well-traveled piece of literature in the world, a book that's migrated across cultures so often it's become a kind of literary silk road, that book would have to be The Arabian Nights. It's a collection of folktales that started in Persia, moved around the Arab world and migrated to Europe. Everywhere they went, they grew until finally, eventually. Well, they're called the Thousand and One Nights for a reason. Steve Paulson has the story.
One of the great things about the Arabian Nights is they appeal to very different audiences. For kids, they're full of exotic and magical creatures, but they're also complicated stories for adults, full of sex and intrigue and even murder. TV producer Shabnam Rezai grew up with these stories in Iran, and she's never forgotten them.
The story goes that the king comes home one day and he finds his wife in bed with all these slaves, and of course she's cheating on him, so he's enraged and he goes into a mad fit and takes out his sword and kills her right there and kills all the slaves. And beyond that, he gets really upset and puts out a decree that says, I'm going to take a virgin wife every night and kill her the next morning.
Because he doesn't think he can trust any women.
Women can no longer be trusted, that's right. So now we have a situation where he goes through all the virgin women in the town and they're all dead and we're only left with one woman, and this is Shahrazad, or Scheherazade, as you say, the daughter of the vizier. The night before she goes in, she asks her little sister, Dunyazade, to come into the bedroom and ask for a bedtime story. And of course, that night, after the king is done with Scheherazade, Dunyazade comes in and says, Sister, it's your last night on this earth. Would you mind parting with us with a good bedtime story? Now, what's very clever about Scheherazade is that she doesn't tell the ending of the story. So right at that cliffhanging moment where we're dying to find out if our hero is going to die or survive this ordeal, she says, you know what, guys? I am a little tired right now and the sun is about to come up. So why don't we take a break and we can follow the rest of this tomorrow.
Sort of like the template of every TV drama.
Absolutely.
You know, it always ends with the cliffhanger.
Is this not the most modern version of the commercial break? Mm-hmm. You know, every time you go out on a TV show that you're watching, they always give you that cliffhanger. And it was invented in the 9th century. I mean, it's brilliant.
She's the ultimate entertainer, the wonderful tailspinner. And one of the things that's difficult when you're trying to write about the Arabian Nights is that the stories are complicated.
Marina Warner is a cultural historian whose book about the Arabian Nights is called Stranger Magic.
They're subtle and ingenious, and the way the details and the plot unfold are definitely in the hands of a skillful embroiderer.
Night after night, Scheherazade stayed alive and kept her head on her shoulders. At last, after 1,001 nights had gone by, the king turned to her and said, Scheherazade, I shall never grow tired of you, and you shall be my queen for as long as we both shall live.
There's something irresistible about the Arabian Nights. It's not just the narrative structure, the stories within stories, or the triumph of Scheherazade in a man's world. It's this whole fantastic universe. I mean, think about it. Centuries before Harry Potter gave us flying cars and floating chandeliers, these were stories packed full of magic.
The djinn, you know, who are the genies who drive the action and who are good and bad. They can go both ways, so they're wonderfully unpredictable. The flying carpet, all the enchanted objects, all this landscape of possibilities opened up doors for people to imagine other worlds.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the cosmology of the Arabian Nights, the djinn. We now often refer to these characters as genies. What role do they play in these stories?
They're rather like our fairies. So whereas we think of as fairies as part of the past, the genies and the djinn of the nights are canonical. They're in the Quran. They're made of shimmering fire, or they're made of water. I mean, they're elemental. They have charge of the wind. They're kind of airy beings. And one of their tasks in the legends and the mythology of Islam is that they carry Solomon through the air on his throne.
Solomon is the all-wise king who presides over this world.
Yes, yes. Solomon is just like the Solomon in the Bible, except he's got more extraordinary stories attached to him in the Arabian Nights. He's the master of the jinn. And the disobedient jinn, the ones who refuse to acknowledge the truth of Allah after the revelation of the Prophet, and the way they're punished is that Solomon shuts them up in copper bottles and tosses them into the depths of the ocean. And that, as you will remember, is the beginning of the famous scene when the fisherman fishes up one of these copper bottles and it's all covered in barnacles and rust. And he opens it, and out swarms this huge pillar of fire, which is the imprisoned genie, and he will give the fisherman everything he wants.
So what'll it be, Master?
You're gonna grant me any three wishes I want, right?
Almost. There are a few provisos, a couple of quid pro quos.
Like?
Rule number one, I can't kill anybody.
Yeah, so don't ask.
Rule number two, I can't make anybody fall in love with anybody else. You little punim there.
Over the last decade, the Arabian Nights have become the subject of intense scholarly interest. There's no better example of how Middle Eastern culture was absorbed by Europeans and how it all got mixed up together to create something new. In fact, Shebnam Rezai says the title of these stories, The Arabian Nights, is actually misleading.
The original tales are called A Thousand and One Nights. And what happened was when they were first brought over to Europe for the first time in the 18th century, the French translators wanted to make it sound exotic. So they called it the Arabian Nights because it was conjuring up Arabia and, you know, maybe women in belly dancing outfits and hookah pipes. In fact, in Persian and in Arabic and in any other language, if you come across the works, they are called 1001 Nights. And the reason 1001 Nights is so much more appropriate is because the book started out in Persia, but then Arab scholars added to it, Indians, Chinese. The most famous stories, Aladdin, Ali Baba, and Sinbad, were added in France by the translators.
Well, that's interesting. So those were not originally stories that came out of Iran? I mean, the most famous ones,
right.
Sinbad, Aladdin?
Yeah. So in 18th century France, there was a writer and a publisher who became very successful. He was publishing one story a day, and he had this little kiosk, and people would line up around the corner to buy these stories from him. And at the time, there were only 283 stories. So by the time the 284th day came along and he'd run out of stories, he panicked and went to the writer and said, I don't have any more stories to sell. And the writer said, well, that's it. I've translated everything. He said, well, guess what? You're going to have to write a couple more for me because these are selling like hotcakes. Huh. And that's what happened.
So here's the most fascinating part of the whole story. The reason we know the Arabian Nights, or if you prefer, A Thousand and One Nights, the reason they're now part of the canon of world literature is because Europeans fell in love with them. In fact, added to them, even remade them at a time when the Arab world had never considered them anything more than folktales.
It is a European phenomenon.
Mohsen al-Massawi, a prominent scholar of Arabic literature.
Because among the elitist circles in the Arab world until sometime in the 13th century, they thought of these kind of tales as unworthy of being written down. The popular was marginalized, was put aside. It was for the street, for the coffee house audiences, that's all. It was only in Europe, and it was very popular, certainly, with the French. But it was in England that it made its enormous reputation.
So you're saying this is a book that had enormous cultural influence over
the
centuries.
Next to the Bible.
And it wasn't just England. Throughout Europe, people were obsessed with what you might call Oriental exoticism. You find it in the operas of Mozart and the books of Europe's most famous writers. For instance, Voltaire's picaresque novel Candide would be unthinkable without the influence of the Arabian Nights.
You know, there are lots of fairy tales in the world, there are lots of myths in the world, but the Arabian Nights had a very special impact in 18th century Europe. They were just taken up by every kind of writer, artist, opera writer, you know, and then in the streets people began drinking coffee, people in their houses began wearing embroidered dressing gowns and turbans. You know, if you look at an 18th century portrait of a kind of writer or a nobleman, he will often be wearing a turban and a Turkish dressing gown. And also, above all, this is what really interested me, there's a freedom.
A freedom to step into a fantasy. What's so striking about the European craze for the Arabian Nights is when it happened. In the 18th century, during the Enlightenment, just as the scientific revolution was exploding all across Europe, when rationality finally seemed to knock religion off its pedestal, so people no longer had to believe in the Bible's miracles. But here you have the Arabian Nights with their flying carpets and magic lamps and genies, which must have given people the sense that a world without God could still feel magical and fantastical, strictly through the power of their imagination. Of course, there's also a politics to all of this, and the risk of stereotyping Muslims and Arabs as exotic characters right out of a fairy tale. But even Edward Said, the Palestinian-American cultural critic who wrote the landmark book Orientalism, had a soft spot for the Arabian Nights. He was never willing to write them off as just another example of how the West had colonized the Middle East. And it's one reason people who come from the Middle East have gone back to the Arabian Nights, even to turn them into TV shows for kids.
1001 Nights! Remarkable sights! With sultans and kings and with magical things from the past.
That's a scene from Big Bad Boo's animated TV series, 1001 Nights, which has aired in dozens of countries around the world, including the Middle East. Shabnam Rezai is the president of her production company.
I'm originally from Iran, and growing up, my father would tell me the tales late at night, and much like Shahrzad, the heroine, who doesn't tell the ending of the story, my father would keep the ending of the story from me, and so I would always be excited for the next night where I had the opportunity to sit with him and hear the rest of the story. So there's great tradition, oral tradition, in passing the stories down from generation to generation.
So you grew up with these stories. Now you live in the United States and also Canada. Why turn them into entertainment for today's children?
Our whole company, Big Bad Boo, is based on the mission and vision of teaching children about different cultures through entertainment. So the idea is to normalize being from a different country. So what's great about 1001 Nights is there are hundreds and hundreds of stories that conjure up genies, viziers, mermaids, evil emperors, and the world is really endless. And in the tradition of 1001 Nights, we are able to embellish and really use our imagination to create something that is modern and appropriate for today's audience.
But Shahrzad, what happened to the flying carpet? I liked that part.
Ah, that's a very good question, Shahzaman. But that would be another story.
Oh, come on!
Please!
I want to hear another one. It's so great!
Yeah.
Steve Paulson brought us the story of the Arabian Nights. If you're looking for a place where East and West, Europe and the Arab world, come together, one place you have to go is Jerusalem. The celebrated Israeli-born chef Yotam Ottolenghi grew up there, as did his Palestinian business partner, Sami Tamimi. The two lived on opposite sides of the city, Tamimi on the Arab east side, Ottolenghi in the Jewish west. They met in London, where together they've opened 5 restaurants. They've just brought out a new cookbook called Jerusalem. It's a celebration of a city and a cuisine that Ottolenghi says brings East and West together.
Jerusalem is probably the archetypal example of cultures that meet and mix and create wonders. It's all about being in the center of either a trade route or a cultural route or an immigration route. And Jerusalem always had that. So if you go back to the biblical times, Egyptians and Jews and Persians and Babylonians and Romans and Greeks, everybody have put their stamp on this place. Immigration is a massive thing. Jews have started coming in big numbers to Jerusalem over the last 100 years, and each community have brought with them their indigenous food. And that's why it's so magnificent and fascinating to eat those things, because you're not just eating a dish. It's not just, burnt eggplant with tahini sauce. It's a whole story coming together on a plate.
So, for instance, what story do you taste in burnt eggplant with tahini?
Burnt eggplant is something that is eaten all around the Middle East. It's a wonderful technique of cooking eggplant, because not only do you get the wonderful flesh, you also get that smoky aroma. In Jerusalem, you've got Palestinians cooking eggplant in such a way. You've got Jews, immigrants from Syria or from Turkey cooking eggplants in such a way all over the Balkans. Each one has got their own little technique. Some add tahini, other add tahini and pomegranate or pomegranate seeds or pomegranate molasses. Other add parsley, the others don't add parsley. Sometimes you get lemon juice and garlic, other times cumin. Each variation is its own story. If you stop at a certain point, you can get a story of an immigration of a family from, let's say, Aleppo in Syria to Israel or Palestine, as it was called. That's a story of a family, that's a story of a dish, and it's a story of an ingredient. And there's tons and tons like that.
Can you sort of bring the tastes and smells of Jerusalem alive for us? Because I'm really taken by the point in your book, Jerusalem, where you and your co-author and your business partner write that you even dream of the smells and the aromas and tastes of Jerusalem. And I just,
yeah.
What are they?
Well, all you can do is just start listing things. You know, I mean, wonderful chopped up salads of tomatoes, fresh cucumbers, onion and cilantro and lemon juice and garlic that goes with almost every meal. Big spreads of mezes, tahini salads and fried cauliflower, kibbeh, which are bulgur wheat sort of dumplings that are stuffed with lamb and pine nuts and then deep fried. Wonderful Eastern European cakes or babkas like or rugala spread out in bakeries in the marketplace. Every possible fruit and vegetable. The climate is just so suitable for that. Olives and lemons and oranges and figs. Tons of figs. You know, more than you can use. Pomegranates and peaches and apricots and walnuts and the marketplaces. I mean, don't get me started on the marketplaces, you know, piles and piles of fruit and vegetables and freshly baked breads.
One of the things that I think is so exciting about your food for Western cooks is that you bring a whole palette of spices and aromatics that we're less familiar with. I've read that you even got some grief from some of your English readers of your newspaper column originally because they would,
yes,
some of the things they weren't familiar with.
Indeed, and I get it all the time, and I'm sort of used to it by now. And I remind them that olive oil was weird here 10 or 15 years ago. You used it to pour into your ears, but nobody ever dared eating it. And things do change, even within the last 10 or 15 years. I can see here, you go to the supermarket and you find sumac, one of my favorite spices. These are crushed berries that are very, very sharp and a little bit sweet, but mostly very sharp, like lemon juice. And they're very common in Turkish cooking and in Iranian and Middle Eastern cooking. And all of a sudden, I go to the supermarket here and I see them on the shelf and I go, oh my God, sumac in a British supermarket. Who would have thought so 3 years ago?
And what do you do with sumac?
Sumac is used for marinating meat, mainly white meats like lamb or chicken. It's got a wonderful red color. So if you marinate a chicken with it, you get a really nice red color all around it. And once it's cooked, it's a deep, deep red.
Now, you also use a lot of pomegranates. And I think in the U.S. often we're used to pomegranates as kind of a decorative item, if anything.
Well, again, this has changed so much here in London since I arrived. Now people realize of what kind of a bonus ingredient it is, because it's, of course, you get this wonderful sweet and sour flavor, but I mean, visually it's so stunning. I mean, just to spoon that over, you know, salad or a dessert, it's the most wonderful thing you can add. And in this Eastern Mediterranean, in Persian cooking, in Arab cooking, it is a key ingredient, especially the molasses, because molasses are basically what they are essentially, is a reduced pomegranate juice that thickens. So it's very sharp and very sweet. It's a bit like the local balsamic vinegar. It's used for dressings, for marinating, for things like duck or chicken. It really is a very versatile thing. And, it, you know, this is why I like using it so much.
It's really interesting to me that the sense of joyousness and celebration and hospitality in food comes to you through the mingling of cultures, which we often see as cultures that are full of conflict and violence. And yet in your food, they're kind of coming together in a very different spirit.
Yes, I think it's probably the greatest contradiction. I think in my mind, our heated culture is also a very creative culture. The people of Jerusalem are very passionate, and that comes across, obviously, in the way they interact with each other, often in a sense of antagonism and almost in conflict, but also with the food and with other things that involve creation. It's a very passionate culture, both the Arab and the Jewish. And as a result, you really have that kind of commitment to a cause. And if the cause is negative, then obviously you get a lot of negativity and very dire consequences. But if it's channeled to other things, to vital things like food, like art, then you get that as well. So the food reflects that national character.
Mm. How does that play out between you and your business partner, Sammy? Because you both grew up in Jerusalem, but you're from an Israeli family. He's from a Palestinian family.
Yeah. Sammy and I, we go back a long way. Although we both grew up in Jerusalem and we're actually incidentally born in the same year, we only met in London about 12 years ago when we were both working in the same place. And we became very good friends. Often we're asked, how does it work for you? You know, if only it could work for others. And I think, sadly, one of the answers we tend to give is that probably it's endured time because we're not right there in the eye of the storm. Had we been living in Jerusalem or in Israel, it would have been tested, our friendship, more often than it does now because of political tensions and all sorts of other things.
Well, it sounds like part of what you're saying is it has to do with what you focus on, right? So you may be from different cultures, but you share so much. And if what you share is focused on something positive, food in this case, the story that you can tell is a story of passion and pleasure. Whereas if what you focus on is political division, then all that passion turns negative.
Yeah, I think that's it. But, you know, it's... I'm saying that. I mean, in Jerusalem, we also have certain collaborations and interactions between Jews and Arabs around food. It's not absolutely impossible. When I did the program on the British television, I went to a restaurant in Jerusalem, and you had a chef, and one of his assistants was a Palestinian, and you could see that they're having a great time, and they both love what they're doing, and they love the food, and they joke. But it's not very common, and that's just because of the environment.
So as the dream of peace in the Middle East seems ever further away, does cooking give you a sense of hope that that could change?
I sort of have a standard answer now because I've been asked this a few times before, and I always say, I don't think cooking or food will bring change, no. But I do think that if the two people will be ready to face each other in a positive way, then food would probably be the first thing that would sit around and share together, because it is the thing that really people do have in common of all other things.
Yota Motolenghi is an Israeli-born chef and cookbook author, and Strange Champs talked with him. You'll find a few of his recipes on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour may be over, but there's more online. Books, music listings, other links. You can listen to the podcast, search the archives, send us questions or comments. You'll find it all at ttbook.org. This hour was produced by N. Strange Champs with help from Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.